Hi, I'm Nicola Elliott and this is the No BS Guide to Wellbeing. It's a place where I'm going to speak to experts in the field of wellbeing who all have a few things in common. So number one, they believe that wellbeing should be absolutely BS free. And number two, they've all been given the challenge of providing us with five of their top tips for wellbeing that we can all easily apply to our lives. Because I believe that the small steps can make a big difference. And hopefully this podcast can take the challenge out of wellbeing and can really empower you in an easy and a simple way to feel your best. So in this episode, I'm going to be talking to Dr. Louise Newson, who is a leading menopause specialist, and she's helped to empower and educate thousands of women on how to deal with the menopause. Now, I really wondered whether this is a topic that we should talk about, namely because I'm not going through the menopause yet. I'm 43, and so, you know, it's probably a little bit off for me. But do you know that the average woman goes through menopause symptoms for 4 years, and actually one in 10 of us can have up to 12 years worth of symptoms? So that's like a big part of our life. And the fact that there's a lot more noise now around us sort of hiding from the menopause and not talking about it. I really believe that at my age, it's something we should be educating ourselves about, so you don't suddenly sort of hit that brick wall, you know, at the point of which you're suffering those symptoms. So Louise is also a founder of a free menopause support app called Balance. And during the episode, we speak about why women need better support and more knowledge during the menopause, and to my point, I think in advance of it. And Louise is going to give us her five top tips that we can all incorporate to help with our well-being on and before our menopause journeys. Hey. Hi, Louise.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing? How's your well-being today?
Good, thank you.
Feeling good?
Yeah.
Fantastic. So, Louise, you are super busy. You're an author, you're a GP, you're a charity founder. Tell us why you feel this big need to talk about the menopause, because I actually have a confession. I'm 43 and I know nothing about the menopause beyond the fact that we get a few hot flushes, and I feel quite embarrassed by that, really. And I think you, it's a big part of your mission, isn't it, to make sure that women, I suppose, of my age, before it sort of hits them, know a bit more and educate themselves on the menopause.
Absolutely. But not just women, actually. Men need to know too, because they know women. And yeah, it's interesting because if you had met me a few years ago, I would have probably said the same as you, actually. I would have said, oh, it's just something that causes a few hot flushes, doesn't it? And that was me as a doctor who had no menopause training. And it was only really when the NICE guidance, the National Institute of Health and Care Excellence guidance, came out in 2015. And it made me really reflect on the literature and the evidence. And as a doctor, I want to practice evidence-based medicine. And it really confirmed how the menopause is not about hot flushes. It's not about a few symptoms. It's about a long-term hormone deficiency with health risks. And I got a background before general practice of being a hospital physician. And I'm very interested in lots of diseases, and I'm very interested in disease prevention. And so when I look at all the diseases that increase during and after the menopause, they are diseases that are really, really important, such as heart disease, osteoporosis, diabetes, dementia, because estrogen is so important. It's a really important hormone for the way we function. And the longer we have without estrogen, the more at risk we are of these diseases. So you look at, well, we've got something that we can replace the missing hormones with, but no one's getting it. Or in the UK, 10% of women are getting it. And I think, well, why? Why have we all been fed wrong information? And all this happened around the same time as my friends were going through their menopause experience, having symptoms. And a lot of them were coming out of their GP practices telling me they were on medications such as venlafaxine or citalopram or sertraline. And I would say, what's going on? These are antidepressants. Why are you being given antidepressants? And they said, well, that's because HRT is going to give me breast cancer. Why would I take that? So then I sat down and thought, oh, my goodness, there's a long way to go. I've prescribed HRT for years. I thought every other GP did it. I didn't realize it was a problem, because in a GP, you just work in your room and that's what you do. And then I sort of took a step back, listened to my friends, and then I started to get a bit busy on social media, and I heard all these stories. And then I opened a clinic, and I am very embarrassed that it's a private clinic, because I couldn't get a job as a menopause specialist in the NHS because they don't really exist. And I started seeing women from all over the country that would travel and see me and tell me that they had stopped working, their partners had left them, their job was just worthless. They were just flatlining. And these were young women with a whole future ahead of them. And then I'd give them HRT because they needed it, because it has more benefits and risks. 3 months later, they would say to me, "You have saved my life. You've transformed my life." Wow. And I'm thinking, what? This is ridiculous, actually. So I just thought, actually, I'm going to make it my mission to really empower women and men, but anyone who will listen, with really good information so they can make the right choices.
It's amazing and clearly so, so needed. But can I, how do you know if you are a woman of, you know, perimenopause right through to, I suppose, halfway through and really sort of suffering? How would I know to have a conversation with my doctor and say, are these symptoms potentially the menopause? Like, presumably those friends of yours that went in and ended up on antidepressants went in and said they were feeling a whole host of symptoms that laddered up to being depressed. So where's the misfire there? And if GPs aren't going to be able to spot that, is there anything that we can do? Or is it as simple as just saying, post the age of 40 or whatever you tell us,
could this be the menopause? Yeah, it's a combination approach, really, to be honest. So there's a few things there. Firstly, most healthcare professionals sadly haven't had good quality menopause education. So if they're not taught, they won't know to ask the right questions. I feel as women, we should be empowered with the right information. But also, it doesn't just affect middle-aged women. So 1 in 100 women under the age of 40 will have an early menopause, 1 in 1,000 under the age of 30. My youngest patient is 19. So wow. It's never too late to find out. You're never too young. It's really, really important because the symptoms are so vague sometimes and change a lot. During the perimenopause, you can have different days with different experiences. And, you know, I'm very embarrassed because I missed my own perimenopause when I was 45 because I was working very hard developing my menopause doctor website. So every night I'm writing it was completely ironic. I'm writing about all these symptoms. I'm getting them, but I'm thinking I'm just tired because I'm working hard. I'm irritable. I'm short-tempered. I've got no interest in anything. But I didn't really realize because you don't when it's yourself somehow. And it crept up very gradually.
So, would you, in that instance, if you had those sort of symptoms, would you always recommend that someone tried the HRT before they went on an antidepressant? Like, can it be a problem, or would you rather try that?
Yes, and it's a really good question. So, I mean, one of the things, obviously, I've developed the free app Balance, so people can download it and can do a menopause symptom questionnaire on it. And what they can do is do it every 3 months. And then you can look and go, oh, goodness me, actually, these symptoms are worse. And then you can monitor your periods if you're having them on the app as well. And then you can download a health report. So, for example, what I should have done is downloaded my own app 5 years ago, but sadly it wasn't available then. And then I would have downloaded my health report, gone to my doctor and said, I've got all these symptoms that have changed. My periods are becoming more irregular. I'm now 45. I really think that I'm perimenopausal. I know a blood test is not going to help, so I'd like to try HRT to see how many of these symptoms are related. And the GP then could start HRT, and that would be my 10-minute consultation, bang, done. And the thing is about HRT, it's really bad, actually, because it's called hormone replacement. When you're perimenopausal, you're not replacing anything. You're just topping up. Mm-hmm. So you're just giving back, you're reclaiming your missing hormones. And it's very low risk now. The HRT we prescribe, the estrogen is usually through the skin as a patch, gel or spray, so there's no risk of clot or stroke. There's no risk of breast cancer with estrogen, and even with the progesterone, there's never been shown to be a statistically significantly increased risk of breast cancer. And there's a lower risk of all those diseases, such as heart disease, osteoporosis, and so forth, I mentioned earlier. So we also know you're never too young, really, to start it. So a lot of women, if you ask them, they'll know it's related to their hormones. And so then you say, well, I'll give you some HRT for 3 months and then let's just see what happens. If they're still having headaches, for example, then you think, well, as a doctor, there are loads of reasons for headaches. Do they need a brain scan? Do they need some other tests? Rather than every single woman in their 40s going to have a brain scan because they've got headaches to make sure there's nothing else going on. And this is, it's really important that we preempt, because what's happening also is that perimenopausal and menopausal women are overloading our healthcare systems, not just in the UK, but abroad. So the number of women who are being referred for palpitations investigations, for bone and muscle pain investigations, for bladder investigations, it is huge. So it's draining our already really, really tired system in that, in our NHS.
And if you had been, if you had gone and been prescribed antidepressants or another medication, as you said, is sort of so common, would that then potentially mask the symptoms of the menopause, so then you could kind of never get to the bottom of it? I mean, that
No. What happens is, we did a study of 3,000 women and we found that 66%, so two-thirds, had either been offered or given antidepressants for their low mood. And what women often say is that it didn't really help, it just numbed some of my symptoms. So a lady a few months ago said to me, I just wasn't bothered. So she said, I scraped my car against the wall driving into my house and I didn't care. Whereas 6 months ago, I would have burst into tears and thought it was the worst thing ever. So, but I know I don't feel happy. I don't feel any different. And a lot of the other symptoms of the menopause will still be there as well.
Understood. I mean, I just think the idea of downloading the app and getting into that rhythm as a woman is so important, because so many times in my life, you know, I've sort of thought, gosh, I wish I'd kept some sort of diary or record of this, and particularly to do with your health. I mean, I've always been terrible, my own sort of cycle or whatever, but you know, your health and so many other sort of lifestyle effects that you have, I think you, we tend to sort of brush them under the carpet. And then it's very difficult when you do decide to address something, to look at it and go, actually, the reality is this has been going on for, you know, 6 months, a year, whatever, a longer period of time. So having that sort of somewhere in black and white feels like a kind of, I don't know, a bit of a basic health 101, really.
Absolutely. And it's really hard, you know, we're all, everyone's busy, aren't they? And I think as women, we're very used to multitasking, getting on with things. And, you know, the older I get, the more I realise, actually, I have to look after myself. I'm in control of my own health. And although other people will say, oh, gosh, you must be really tired, or are you looking after yourself? Day to day, no one really cares, do they? It has to come from within, and you have to take a step back and think, right, what's going wrong with my life? What's happening? And, you know, I had such extreme tiredness. I felt like I'd been drugged. It was worse than being pregnant. And I was really scared, actually, because I thought I had something really serious going on with me, because I was so overwhelmingly tired. But if I'd read that it was a very common symptom of the perimenopause and just had literally 2 minutes of either my best friend sitting down with me or reading a book or downloading the app, just telling me, actually, don't be scared. This is very common in the mid-40s, and this is what might happen, and this is what the help you can get, then it would have saved me 6 months of really struggling.
And but, is, you know, is that, kind of, can I ask sort of what those key symptoms are that you would typically be seeing from someone? And I know it's maybe, you know, you said there's so many of them, but what are probably the commonest symptoms that you see women coming in for if you, you know, if you're sort of new to this journey?
Yeah, I mean, 75% of women probably have the vasomotor symptoms, hot sweats and flushes, but that means one in four women don't. And it's really common, the psychological symptoms, because the hormones, estrogen and also testosterone, are really, really important the way our brains work and function. So it's very subtle symptoms, like just being a bit joyless, a bit flat, not interested in things, harder to concentrate, harder to remember names or dates. Also, sleep is a massive, massive symptom of the perimenopause and menopause. So people find, they might find it hard to get to sleep. They're waking up early, or they're finding it very difficult to just stay asleep in the same way that they would have done before. And obviously, not having sleep is a form of torture and can really, really affect how people function.
Mm-hmm.
Muscle and joint pains are also very common symptoms, and pins and needles, tinnitus, ringing in the ears, dry mouth, dry eyes are very common. Also, urinary symptoms. So people often say they're getting up to the toilet, to go to the toilet two or three times a night, or they're finding it harder to hold on to urine, or when they cough and sneeze, they have a bit of dribbling or leakage. And they think that's just normal because they're getting older. It's not normal, and it needs to be thought of as, is it related to my hormones?
So if I had some of those symptoms, I can go to the GP and say, listen, I've tracked myself on this balance app. Here is, you know, the data that shows I felt like this for sort of a substantial period of time. And can you please give me some HRT? You can be as explicit as that?
Absolutely. The problem is it's all about, like I said before, joining the dots. A lot of healthcare professionals haven't had menopause training. So what they might do is say, no, that's not true, you're too young, or you need to be menopause, or your periods need to have stopped, or HRT is too dangerous. But then what we need to do is say, well, actually, who in this practice has had menopause training? And one of the things, as you might know, since I founded the charity, is we gave away a free education program to every GP practice in UK and Ireland. And this is an online program where people can watch lectures and watch consultations with actresses and read the evidence and the guidelines. So we've made it very easy for them to do this. And so if you don't get the right help, which a lot of women sadly still aren't, I really feel very strongly that it's not the doctor's fault, it's the fault of the system. So rather than, which is very tempting, shouting at your doctor, which I would have done because I couldn't get HRT from my GP, it's better to be calm and say, I know the evidence shows that the earlier you take HRT, the better, not just for my symptoms, but for my future health. I'm going to leave you some information. I would like you to tell me who's done the course or who knows about the menopause. And I'd like to come back for another consultation to get HRT. And we now have guidelines from NICE on shared decision making. And that means that patients can share the decision making about their treatment, which is so important. And it's really important with HRT. So I'm not saying that everyone has to take HRT, but I'm saying everyone who wants it should be able to have it. And that's not happening at the moment. So that needs to change.
Well, I am certainly downloading the app and filling that in today, Louise. I want to speak about your five ways of well-being. We always ask on the Neon podcast your five ways, the stuff in your well-being toolkit that you can share with us, the kind of the fail-safe tips. So I know your first one is about optimizing the perimenopause and a menopause in a holistic way. Can you tell us about that? What do you mean about optimizing? Like, kind of what does that entail?
What we need to do, optimize, is get the best of what you can get. So it's all, you know, if you said to me, well, the best you'd feel is if you could run a marathon every month. Well, I could say, I'm sorry, I'm never going to run a marathon, so I'll never.
Yeah, me too.
But it's optimizing for yourself. And so I think it's looking at, obviously, balancing your hormones is key, making sure your knowledge is good, but optimizing everything else in your health. So we all know there are things we could do better, and some of them are achievable and some of them aren't, but it's looking at the achievable ones. And then that, even just little changes, you know, reducing that glass of wine or not having that coffee last thing at night that you know is going to affect your sleep, just making little changes can really have a massive difference to the future. And as we get older, we can't wing things like we could when we were younger. I look at my teenage children.
I know.
I wish I could just eat a pizza and, you know, watch a horror film till 3 a.m. and then be okay and look amazing the next morning. But it's not going to happen. You know, so we have to sort of look at how we can not just make each day good, but our future health good as well.
Totally with you. So the second one is the practice of regular meditation. Why is this important to you? Do you meditate regularly?
Yeah, I do actually. I do a lot of yoga, especially Ashtanga yoga. And at the end, and the relaxation, I often meditate because every day I say I couldn't work any harder, and then something else happens, and I've never ever worked this hard in my life.
Oh, but God, I know what you mean when it gets like that, because it's like, can you shove anything else in? Oh, well, yes, it's a bit more and a bit more.
But I always carve out time for yoga. I do practice at least twice a week, and it's really important time for me, as is meditation, because my brain becomes too cluttered otherwise, and then I can't do my job properly. So if I'm sitting here doing a podcast with you, there's no point thinking about the next meeting I have, what my children are going to have for supper, and I've got a meeting tonight, and how am I going to get home, and what's the traffic going to be like? Because it's all irrelevant, isn't it? Mm. I'm here concentrating on the job now, which is talking to you. So I have to free my brain of all the other noise. And I think you can only do that if you know how to meditate and clear your brain really regularly, because otherwise thoughts become very overwhelming. And the power to control our brains, I think, is just the most incredible power to have.
I totally, totally agree on that. And it's one of those things that if you do it for a few days and then you miss a few days, I can instantly sort of notice the difference. And your number three is learn how to develop a powerful yoga practice. But you sort of explained about that. You have yoga classes at your centre as well, don't you?
Yeah, I do. We're very lucky. We rent this building here, which used to be the registry office. It's a beautiful Grade 2 listed building in the middle of Stratford-upon-Avon. And the room that they use for the ceremonies is this lovely, big, high-ceilinged room. And I just came in and I said, this would be the most amazing yoga studio. And everyone just looked at me and laughed. And my finance director said, no, you can have about 4 consultation rooms in here. No way.
I know that feeling.
Absolutely not. So I'm very lucky. I have a really amazing instructor called James Critchlow, who's in his 60s. He's a real yoga guru. And he comes and teaches every Wednesday morning. And it's just lovely. There are 3 of us and we do a directed Ashtanga practice.
Is that 3 of you that work for you?
One of them is one of my best friends. And then the other one is Lucy Holtham, who is an incredible yoga teacher. And she has known James for a long time. So she comes and has the lesson with James, and then she carries on and teaches other people in their time. So it's amazing, actually. It's a dream job, isn't it? I have a big meeting on a Wednesday morning, and then I cut it at 10 o'clock. Go and do yoga, have a shower, and then I carry on working.
Yeah, I do think it sounds lovely, but you know what? I think it sounds less indulgent and more of actually that sort of becoming a bit of a hygiene factor, especially if you're in a well-being business. I mean, we try and integrate that quite a lot into working at Neon, because I think you can't speak about it and then not sort of, you know, live it as a team.
No, I think it's really important. So I offer yoga, actually taught by Lucy, on a Saturday morning to all my staff. So I pay for it, and they do it. Obviously now it's through a Zoom link, and we record it so people can then dip in to it afterwards. And I think that's just a perk of being here. There's no point me indulging in myself and not looking after staff.
That's totally right. And the fourth one, I'm not sure about this one, Louise, avoiding alcohol. This is quite a tricky subject, and I don't know if I can do this. In fact, I think I was better at this in my 30s than I probably am in my 40s, but you can try and sell the concept to me.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I've never been a big drinker at all, but I used to probably about 15 years ago, I was getting quite a lot of palpitations, and they were really horrible, actually. They would sometimes really affect, even I'd get some chest pain and shortness of breath. And I kept saying to my husband, these are really scary. I had lots of tests. They were absolutely fine. Looking back, I'm sure it's my hormones. But one of my doctors said to me, well, just give up alcohol and caffeine. And I went, don't be daft. I could give up alcohol, but not caffeine. I need that 10 o'clock in the morning coffee. But I didn't want to come in having palpitations. So I stopped caffeine, stopped eating chocolate, stopped drinking alcohol. I get migraines as well. And within a few months, I suddenly thought, gosh, I feel so much better, actually. And then about 8 years ago, I developed pancreatitis, which, if any of you are listening, had, it's horrendous. It's the worst pain you can ever experience. And it's usually brought on if you drink alcohol or if you have gallstones. And I was I wasn't drinking alcohol and I didn't have gallstones. And I was in hospital for a few days, and it has quite a high death rate from it. And the first night I thought, this is it, this is dreadful. And I just thought, I'm going to do everything I can to stay well. And clearly having alcohol when you've had pancreatitis just is a no-go. But I don't miss it. And I think so it's pretty different.
Yeah, you're pretty motivated, weren't you, I suppose, to give up?
It's different. You know, like if I had, you know, when the children were younger and they're eating Maltesers, I thought, oh, I'll just have one because I can. And now I look at chocolate and think, no, I can't because it will trigger either migraines or palpitations. I look at alcohol and I remember how ill I was with pancreatitis. So when there's almost a medical reason not to have something, it's very, very easy decision. But also because I've been so long without alcohol, I actually really, really don't miss it. And it means that I'm very, very productive with my time. You know, my husband will switch off, have a glass of wine and watch a really good film. And I'm there thinking, right, who can I email? What can I do? What can I write? How can I help? And I don't mind that my brain doesn't switch off with alcohol because I suppose I meditate and do yoga and I sleep well. So
I always think that every new year, I always think I need to do like a year of not drinking, like a proper experiment.
You have to do it a long time.
You have to do it a long time. And I think, God, in all the years that you've had, you know, one is not a lot to take out of it from a drinking point of view. But then, that sort of always goes by the way. I'd come fab, but maybe if I had a few more palpitations. By the way, the palpitations weren't after like a big night out, were they? Because I do get those.
No.
They were just around. Okay, so the fifth one, I think this is brilliant. Focus on being the best version of yourself and be fully aware of your limitations. I completely agree, but explain what you mean by that, and why would you say it's important to know our limitations? This is actually something I teach my kids. I think it's not very fashionable.
Well, there's a few things here. I think it's really important to be realistic, because if you're not realistic, you're going to be a failure or failure right from the word go. I think if you have realistic and not too ambitious expectations, you can only feel successful. And it's really hard to measure success. And I have complete imposter syndrome, so I think about what I need to do, not what I've done. But sometimes it's quite useful to think about what you have done. But also I think, as a doctor, it's the most amazing privilege to hear stories from people who you probably wouldn't connect with in other ways, to visit them in their houses, to see and hear how they really live. And it's so easy to judge people and think they're successful because they've got a really lovely handbag or a lovely car or a lovely house. But when you get to know what's going on in people's lives, most of us have got some sort of worry or concern or tragedy that we've had in the past. And so it's very easy. How do you measure success? And I think that's when, you know, having our health is the most successful thing we can have, actually. So I think it's really important that we are careful how we judge others and how we judge ourselves and what we try and aim for, because otherwise you're just set up for failure and you're set up to just feel a worse version of yourself. So, and sometimes I think, I mean, I've had some really big ambitions, which I've nearly achieved. But if I told someone, they would have just laughed in my face and said, there's no way you could develop an app, have the largest menopause clinic in the world in 3 years, and also found a charity and have a not-for-profit company developing free resources for healthcare professionals. But I was quietly confident I could do it if I had the right team of people. But it's giving them the confidence that they can do it and share that journey with me without being arrogant about it. So
I think there's something quite interesting there about not mixing up ambitions with happiness. Yes. Like, set your ambitions to stretch yourself, but you know, your happiness is not fulfilled or not fulfilled if you reach that target or not, right? Yeah, they're two different things, and you want to keep kind of pushing that ambition, but you know, yeah, it doesn't. I mean, I always think as well, from the children's point of view, for sure, we focus, don't we, as they go through school on kind of building up the things that they aren't good at. Mm. It's like that kind of that book, that Strength Finder book. I don't know if you've read that, but you kind of do this quiz and then it sort of plops out what your strengths are versus you. And there's this whole kind of concept that actually if we build on the things that we're naturally good at, like just ditch the things that we're not, rather than actually as a society we focus on them. It's just, it's kind of crazy. I mean, I was only ever good at like two things at school, and it served me quite well actually, because quite quickly I got those other things off my agenda. So I do always talk to the children about, look, it's fine if you're only good at one or two things, focus on those, and actually that's where you put your energy and your effort.
It's so important. You know, I've got three daughters, and a couple of years ago, I kept saying to my middle daughter, Sophie, do you know what? I can't do this, Sophie. I'm just not strong enough. I'm not made up for it. And she was really, of course you can, mummy. Of course you can. Look what you've done. Look how people are listening. You've got to carry on. You've deserved, you know, you've got to do it. It's not fair on other women if you give up now. What are you doing? And I said, but I'm neglecting you. It's terrible. I should be at home all the time for you. And she said, don't be daft. I love being able to catch the train home from school. I love some space on my own.
As long as you give me some more money for sweets or something, totally. I usually get that tagged on the end.
It is really interesting, but it's also, I think, knowing how to compartmentalize your time, because, you know, when I'm with my children, that is really, really important. And I'm forever on my phone and it drives them mad, but they're forever on their phones too, but for different reasons. Yeah. But actually, you know, sometimes just to sit on my daughter's bed and chat to her and still be on my phone, we get to have the best conversations than trying to be there micromanaging her all the time.
Yeah, and I think that's also about kind of, you know, just giving up this fascination with being perfect, right? Like, you know, you're doing all the things, they're not all done perfect. You know, one might be 7 out of 10, one might be 8 out of 10. You might be, you know, slothing in at sort of 7 out of 10 with your mothering, but actually in the round, it all kind of works. I'm always in favor of just, yeah, taking that perfectionism and throwing it out the window. So I think your middle daughter is totally right. You absolutely have to continue doing this, Louise, because you're doing it so well and nobody else is doing it and we need it. So I'm going to be downloading the app, and I'm going to be strongly advising that all my friends do, whether they're feeling a symptom or they're not, they should still be doing it, and teaching our daughters about it and spreading the word. So thank you so much for coming on. Really, really appreciate it. I've learned so much today.
Brilliant. And, thanks.
I really have. Thanks ever so much, Louise. You take care.
And you.
Bye.